And welcome back to Dads on the Air, coming to you around Australia on the Community Radio Network. In this program, we bring you informing and entertaining conversations with a wide range of interesting people on topics of fatherhood, family and parenting, men's and boys' issues, and more. Hi, I'm Bill Cable, and our special guest today is Frank Faridi, Emeritus Professor of Sociology at the University of Kent in the United Kingdom, a public intellectual and a commentator, the author of a number of acclaimed books, including Culture of Fear, Politics of Fear, Where Have All the Intellectuals Gone, and Paranoid Parenting. Professor Faridi's latest book is How Fear Works, The Culture of Fear in the 21st Century, published by Bloomsbury. Professor Faridi, welcome to Dads on the Air.
Pleasure. Thanks very much for having me.
So, Frank, you say in your book that fear is the principal motivational force in the 21st century. That's a pretty big statement. I'm just wondering what drives you to say that.
Well, I think one of the developments that I see around me is that most of the forces that motivate humanity, things like ideologies, religion, political beliefs, confidence in science, have become relatively marginal, relatively feeble in terms of being able to inspire people. And I think as a result of that, the media, the political class, advocacy groups often use fear as a resource through which they try to win over support for their particular cause. And whenever you open up a newspaper, you'll find that there are claims being made that, you know, sort of men's sperm count is declining dramatically. The day after, you hear about how global warming is going to destroy our way of life. By the time you get to Friday, you would have heard about crime and terrorism, obesity becoming worse and worse all the time. And you know, if you look around you, it's never the case that anything seems to get better. We're always told that the situation is getting worse and worse, and there are all these invisible dangers ahead of us. And I think that kind of culture of fear has become utilized so consistently that we almost sort of don't even notice it anymore.
Yes, certainly with elections coming, we seem to hear the fear mantra seems to come out very frequently from our politicians, doesn't it? It works, I guess, is the problem.
Yes, and I think, you know, there used to be a time when what used to divide politicians is their principles, their political beliefs, their ideologies, whereas now what divides them is what kind of fears they promote. So some people argue that the biggest threat to the world is global warming. Others argue that the biggest threat is global terrorism. And you will have, you know, all kinds of competitions occurring, what I call competitive claims making as to what it is that we should fear. And I think if you look at the election campaigns in most Anglo-American societies, you will find that the language of hope is conspicuously feeble. Instead, what we hear is the language of fear.
In your book, you distinguish fear from anxiety. I just wonder, how would you describe fear in this context?
Well, I use fear in a cultural sense, in the sense that fear in our world becomes this cultural force that we almost sort of been socialized into seeing the worst case scenario in every possible situation. And in that sense, it's something that becomes almost like a story in itself. It becomes almost like the prism or the focus to which we see all problems. Whereas anxiety is really this kind of diffuse sense of uncertainty that is part of our human conditions. And anxiety about children, anxiety about people living near us who we don't like or don't understand, anxiety about our future is a normal part of life. And when anxiety becomes politicized, as it does now, it acquires a much more tangible, as a readily recognizable form of fear.
Yes, it's strange that for many of us in Australia and the West in general, I suppose, we have prosperity, we have great security, and yet there's a climate of fear. Is that once again the politicians just seeking an easy advantage?
Well, I think that there's something more there, because the reason why politicians seek advantage or use fear is because it's already in the air and it's already become a medium through which we interpret the world. I think that the reason why this occurs is because we've lost a sense of trust or confidence in our institutions. We no longer have a clarity about what are the moral values that bind us together. In fact, what are the values that define who we are? When we bring kids up, we very often find it difficult, we struggle to tell them the distinction between right and wrong. And we know that even if we know what's right and wrong, it may not be the case that other children's parents share our view of, you know, of what is a good life, in a sense. And I think in circumstances where there's such fundamental confusion about the world, where we're so poor at dealing with uncertainty, fear of the world kicks in, and it then becomes a resource that can be used by advertisers, public relations people, the media, and politicians.
On the larger scale of things, it seems to me America has this extraordinary fear of their own security, which has perhaps led to this gun culture that they live under.
Yes, I mean, I think America is interesting because a lot of the fears that are popular in our world are usually originate from one part of America, which is California. That's where they kind of kick in. And it kind of migrates to the eastern seaboard of the United States gradually. And a month later, it comes to Great Britain. And then it comes to other parts of Europe and Australia and Canada. So there's a kind of global pattern that you'll find that a lot of the things that Australians worry about in the 21st century have their origin in terms of the way they were framed and the kind of language that are used to describe it in the United States. And as a result of that, you do have an incredible degree of obsessiveness about fear. I mean, I go to America a lot, and the way that they deal with children, the way they kind of, almost like children, become battery children, protected from being exposed to the real world, the way they deal with security on the street, they're so obsessive about walking by themselves, and they always have all these strategies for dealing with danger. It is very, very sad. And as it indicates, you know, we never lived at a time when we were so prosperous and had so much resources and technology at our disposal. And yet there seems to be a paradoxical situation where the more opportunities that we have, the more we have become closed off to them.
Fear has, I suppose, always been with us, but it seems to have taken on a different meaning. And you point a lot to the language of fear, because one example you gave was a God-fearing man was something good. But now fear always seems to be something to be avoided.
Yes, I think if you look at human history, fear has always been there, and there is nothing wrong with fearing. You know, fearing is a natural response to threats that we face. So if you're being attacked by a lion, or if you're being attacked by somebody with a gun in their hands, you're quite right to fear and do what you can to protect yourself. And I think what has changed is that in the past, we used to have a kind of a capacity to deal with some of our fears. And, you know, we already had, as far back as the ancient Greeks, the idea that the way you deal with fear is you cultivate confidence, you rely on the virtue of courage. You try to develop a philosophical antidote to fearing. And I think that kind of approach existed all the way through until the early 20th century, when gradually these philosophical ideals, these religious ideals, these moral ideals that we used to deal with fear became medicalized. And I think increasingly from the 20th century onwards, it was psychology that provided us with the tools for dealing with our fears. And I think that as fears became increasingly more and more medicalized, it also changed who we are. We began to think of ourselves as far less able to cope, far less resilient, far in need of expert protection to be insulated from these threats. And I think that has meant that our capacity as a society to manage fear and deal with it and contain its destructive effects has become, to some extent, diminished.
Yes, you point to the inaugural speech of Franklin Roosevelt in 1933 when he made perhaps one of the most famous pronouncements on fear when he said, we have nothing to fear except fear itself. And that seems to be, perhaps that was a turning point when we moved from, say, the religious fear of hell and all the other things to a fear of fear itself.
Yes, I think you're right. I think that at some point, you know, sort of fear is no longer directed at anything specific, at a specific tangible object like, you know, a person with a knife in their hands, or a fear of a particular epidemic of smallpox, or any kind of direct tangible threat. Fear becomes, as you suggest, a fear of itself. And what happens is that fear acquires this free-floating character that can attach itself to virtually anything that you feel like. And what we see is that from that period onwards, decade by decade, our capacity to have this sense of fearing increases, and we become less and less able to feel secure. And I think one of the downsides of that is that we begin to become scared of risks instead of regarding risk as an opportunity. We become scared of uncertainty. I mean, I remember as a child, you know, my dad telling me, you know, Frank, sometimes you've got to take risks. There are good risks and there are bad risks. Mm. Well, today, to use the word a good risk is to sound irresponsible, because in our world, all risks are seen as being negative and dangerous. So attitudes have changed in a very fundamental sense in the last 30 or 40 years. And we don't often realize just how different we are in terms of the way we regard the future, uncertainty, compared to societies in the past.
And not only are those fears still with us, but there's been a tendency to inflate fears. You talk about, you know, a simple barbecue might now be regarded as a breeding ground for salmonella. There might be malaria. There could be food bugs. There could be all sorts of dangers if you want to look at it in that way.
Yes, and I think that's inevitable, because if you think that you and I are not very good at dealing with the threats we face, we have this diminished sense of our capacity to deal with uncertainty, then the corollary of that is that we inflate the threats out there. And I always remember when I was in Australia about a decade ago, and we were in Queensland on a golf course, and my wife and I and my son, who was, I think, around 13, 14 at the time, we're riding our bicycles, and all of a sudden a police car pulled up, and the policeman started yelling at us for not wearing a helmet and gave me a big lecture as to, you know, how irresponsible I was to allow my boy to bicycle without a helmet. And this is not in a golf course, not exactly in downtown Sydney with heavy traffic. And I just said, are you out of your mind? And then I was reminded that actually we were breaking the law, because apparently, according to the law, we were meant to be wearing helmets when we ride a bicycle in all kinds of circumstances. And I thought about it afterwards, and I said, you know, what has the world come to where we literally, you know, sort of develop these insane attitudes towards safety and security, to the point at which, you know, we kind of regard all risks that we face as somehow a medical problem, a danger to us.
Well, this might be a very late apology for that. It's hard to understand, yes, a helmet on a golf course. But, I mean, perhaps a lot of these things are equally foolish when you look at them. I mean, you know, you hear parents say, I wouldn't let my child get the bus to school anymore. You know, I did it for all my life, but, you know, I wouldn't let my child. And things like this, which just seem unrealistic.
Yes, it is. And I've noticed it happening, because I wrote a book called Paranoid Parenting, which I think was published in 2001, and I wrote about how, you know, the world of children has changed in a very fundamental sense. But since I wrote that book in 2001, there are so many things that you could still do, or your child could still do in 2001, that are now banned, for example, in Britain. So in the next 17 years, the freedom that children could enjoy in the outdoors has been further confined. The activities that they could be involved in has become further reduced. And you'll find that, you know, year by year, we seem to be completely devoted towards turning children into indoor little people who live in their digital bedrooms and become entirely insulated from the uncertain experiences of outdoor life. And when we do that, then we wake up one morning and we realize, well, maybe they're facing risk and threats online, you know, on their computers, and then we become totally freaked out by what it is that they're subjected to online. And we then revisit the same kind of panics about our children in their digital bedroom as we did in the outdoors, and it just kind of continues and continues and continues.
And perhaps another thing we need to be careful of, which you point out, is the effect of language. You know, words like time bomb and future-proofing and our friend Donald Rumsfeld's unknown unknowns, all these things are going to increase the fear level, aren't they?
Well, if not increase it, at the very least, it will sensitize us to expect the worst possible outcome. That's one of the things I'm most concerned about, is that so many dimensions of our life and our experience come with this health warning, and where we are looking at, you know, the worst possible dimensions that can happen to us, we begin to think, you know, that that's the most likely development that's going to occur. And I think under those circumstances, it changes the way we relate to each other, the way we live our lives, the way we work.
There's also this moral dimension of fear. I mean, the example you gave of with your own son, I mean, that policeman was talking to you in front of your son with really some sort of moral righteousness that you should have had the helmet on the golf course, wasn't he?
Well, that's right. I have a chapter in the book where I talk about the fact that in many ways the fundamental value of a society like Australia or the UK has become safety. I mean, safety has become almost like being godly or holy in the way we use it. It's become this sacred sentiment, and anybody that does anything that is deemed unsafe, and what's deemed unsafe expands all the time. I know from my own experience that, you know, we were one of the few families that allowed our kid to play in the park. And we used to get these phone calls from other parents saying, well, if you allow, you know, your son to do that, then we're not going to allow our children to play with your son because, you know, they might get into trouble. And there's all this sense of, you know, this idea that somehow I was being morally inferior by the fact that I wasn't, you know, sort of, you know, creating this digital leash around my son.
Yes, in Australia, I think we have a particular exposure to this. You point out some government advertising campaigns where they put a very bad moral connotation on saying boys will be boys, which seemed a fairly innocent expression, but now it's turned into something sinister.
Yes, I've noticed that. The very fact that, you know, the idea that being that boys being boys is somehow an inherently kind of destructive, violent state of mind, and instead of cultivating what I think are healthy and positive boyish virtues, things like courage, things like risk-taking, things like experimenting and trying new things out in the world, instead of attaching those positive qualities to being a boy, stigmatization of boys will be boys actually suggests that, you know, if you're a boy, then basically lurking inside of you is this impulse to beat people up, to sexually assault young girls, and to turn into an abuser when you become an old person. And I think that sense of that loss of reality, which your government's advertising campaign sort of communicates, is actually quite dangerous because it kind of undermines the capacity of young boys to grow up into balanced, healthy individuals who are able to be both courageous, or at least aspire to courage, whilst at the same time being sensitive to the world around them. I think that, you know, that loss of moral dimension in Australian high society, I find extremely disturbing, because, you know, when you look at Australians' history, those very basic virtues like courage and duty and, you know, risk-taking were really important in creating what Australia later became.
Yes, we'd like to think so. And you wrote an article in The Australian recently which commented on the Gillette ad that's getting coverage around the world at the moment. And you point out that some advertisers have embraced virtually a cultural crusade against masculinity. You know, we really are under threat with this sort of approach.
Well, I think what's really disturbing is about masculinity is not only does it misunderstand what manhood is or what being masculine is. You know, being masculine doesn't mean you kind of sort of show off all the time and you just drink beer on the streets and try to beat people up or intimidate them. Being masculine is really about trying to cultivate the habit of control, self-control, try to be independent-minded in the way you behave, try to give a lead in society. It's got a lot of positive qualities, but all those have been, in a sense, stripped away from our new 21st version of masculinity. And what I argue is that actually, you know, what's important about the crusade against masculinity is not what it does to boys, but to society as a whole, mm-hmm. because whether you're a man or a woman, you know, those qualities are really quite important. And myself, I've always admired women who were able to demonstrate precisely those virtues, courageous women.
So we're speaking today with Professor Frank Furedi from the University of Kent. Frank, without paraphrasing you, I'm just wondering if you could sum up the fix that we need. Would you point to things like courage, duty, judgment, and knowledge? They seem to be the important qualities.
I think so. I think those qualities are really important. But in particular, I think what's important is we need to reflect and think about the way we bring young people up, because I think the solution to many of the problems that we've discussed is to adopt a way of bringing kids up, of socializing them in such a way that we cultivate their habit of independence, that we educate them for freedom, and we give them an understanding of those values and those virtues that they need to be able to stand on their two feet, do active things in the outside world, and through realizing that what they do makes a difference, gain positive insights.
This is such a fascinating and important topic. I'm sure we could talk for a lot longer, but we've reached the stage of the program where we ask our guests to pick a song. So, Frank Furedi, would you like to tell us which song you've picked and why?
Well, I picked Jerry Rafferty's Baker Street, which I really like. It's something that I particularly like because it kind of sneaks up on you out of nowhere when you hear the saxophone riff. It's got this very incredibly interesting quality, and the little story behind it, which is, I never heard of the song, but then what happened was that this woman who I was going out with, who I kind of fell in love with day by day more and more, we decided to spend a day together and walk around London and get to know each other better, and we went into a kind of a bar in Kensington one afternoon. And as we were sitting there, we were having a beer, this song came on. And the song somehow kind of brought us closer together. She already heard the song. She explained to me who Rafferty was and what the song was really all about. But I hadn't. And every time I think of her, and she later became my wife, you know, sort of every time I kind of think of that particular moment and that song, it really reminds you of that magical moment of transition where the person you think you might love and might be forever, in a sense, at least for a very long time, that song, that moment, and what happens afterwards are kind of invisibly meshed together. So, yes, that's why I chose that song.
And that was Baker Street by Jerry Rafferty, specially chosen for us today by our special guest, Professor Frank Faridi. Frank, it just remains me now to thank you very much for being a guest on Dads on the Air.
Well, thanks very much. It was a pleasure talking to you.
That's great. And don't forget, we'd love to hear from any of our listeners. You can go to our website, dadsontheair.com.au, and you can follow us on Facebook or Twitter. And we'll be back next week with another show on Dads on the Air.